Hi everyone. My name is Debbie Franzese, and I'm a partner in the investment management practice at Seward and Kissel. And today I'm very pleased to be joined by Jason Mitchell, the co-head of responsible investing at Man Group. Jason, thank you so much for joining us today. This is going to be part of our ESG Spotlight series. And so we're going to be talking about ESG and responsible investing today. But before we get started on that very interesting topic, I'll just let Jason introduce himself and tell you a little bit about his role at Man Group.
Sure, and thanks so much for the invitation to be on this. This is fantastic. So again, I'm Jason Mitchell, co-head of responsible investment at Man Group. I've been in the investment industry for about 20 years, specifically the sustainable finance side for about 10 to 12 years. I've been with Man for a very long time, coming up on about 15, 16 years. And so most of that, my background is on the PM side or on the investment side, both long short and long only. Although I've moved over the last couple of years into this dedicated role as co-head of responsible investment, where I oversee everything from product strategy to research to the development of our ESG, data analytics platform to thought leadership, and certainly as well as stewardship, and certainly sort of our many of our activities, in the wider community.
That's great. Thanks for that introduction, Jason. So obviously, as many of our listeners are investment management clients and portfolio managers, they'll be very familiar with Man Group as an organization. Obviously, has global reach. So I know that you've focused as an organization on integrating ESG throughout the firm, both kind of in the investment process, also within the firm. As the investment manager, and then also as an allocator with respect to funds that you invest in. Can you just cover that a little bit and just talk a little bit about how you think about ESG, kind of in those different aspects?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think we're fairly unique. I mean, there are other multi-strat asset managers out there, and I think they would probably run into the same kind of issues as we have. But I had come up through the discretionary part, the Man GLG side, where we were on discretionary long only and long short. And so it took a number of years to kind of get comfortable across all of Man's businesses. We have five. There's two very different quant businesses, a fund of funds business, a private markets business, and this discretionary business. And I think when you think about it and through the lens of sustainable finance, it means a couple things. So first, when we think about responsible investment, and I define that as sort of frameworks covering everything from policies to our organizational framework to stewardship, research, our analytics platform that range across the firm, there's absolutely a unifying approach. I think when it comes to the integration of ESG, there is absolutely not. And that's a good thing. In fact, actually, that's a great thing. I think, I would even say it's a necessary thing. And the way I describe us is that, those five businesses, they're almost like five streets, and they kind of meet in this very noisy, busy intersection. And within that, you have differing, often conflicting views, approaches, expectations, use cases about what ESG is, right? Is it a bottom-up factor as we've described it for the last, two decades in terms of fundamental research and company engagement? Or is it a top-down factor that quant strategies can identify across sectors, markets, regions? Well, what about private markets? How do you look at it through that lens? How do you allocate it from a fund of funds perspective through that lens? And so I think what that all of those pressures have meant is just a really fascinating intellectual debate about what we're trying to kind of create as a firm. And that I would say that that's not necessarily always about an investment product.
Yeah, no, I think, that's something that people are always thinking about is that ESG means a lot of different things in a lot of different areas. And so, I think, that brings us to really our next question. There isn't really one kind of uniform approach to thinking about ESG or even really a uniform definition of what it means for different firms. So how do you really focus on, ESG within kind of the investment process? How do you think about it? Is it more of kind of an integration approach with those funds where that's appropriate?
Sure. I mean, it's a great question, and I'd sort of it's a good follow on from the last one. But what I'd say is that, I mean, first I'd take a step back and say, look, in terms of ESG and particularly ESG, all this data that's helping us understand what it is, where it lives, you know, and how to allocate to or away from it. I think what there have been a couple lessons from us. I mean, first, when you look at sort of this hierarchy of what data is, you find that there's a number of different kinds. There's unstructured data, there are standards, there's context, and then there's signal or factor. And I think that whether you're an asset manager, an asset owner, a consultant, you should be asking yourself first, where do I enter into that sort of that paradigm? Do I buy off the table shop, off the table data, and sort of create products that are notionally best in class, and I would say sort of superficially integrated, you know, in that way, they're more data slash score driven, or do I start taking this data and actually adding some value add and creating some proprietary tools, right? And this sort of speaks to your point about integration and integration from a quant perspective using different types of tools, integration from, let's say, an old school bottom up fundamental perspective where you're actually using those tools and engaging with companies and trying to sort of tease out that the ESG risks and opportunities alongside, you know, the financial profile of that. So that's the first question. And the second one, to come back to my answer, last one is, you know, out of all of this integration, what are you trying to solve for? So I think most managers, I think the natural stance for any manager, including our, you know, ourselves, is you're kind of looking through this space through the lens of product development, right? We've created a lot of either through the use of quantitative tools or through, you know, engagement and sort of fundamental ESG research and better integrated strategies. We've created, there's this sort of sort of tendency to kind of want to create products out of it. And that's absolutely necessary, right? It's a commercial reality. I think one of the most interesting lessons that I've learned over the last couple of years in particular is that it's a necessary element of what we're doing, but it's not certainly the only element. And actually, I would probably even say that it's probably not the most interesting one. The most interesting one is actually taking all of these integration approaches and sort of looking at it through the lens of, I don't know, call it risk management, or, you know, there's that old saying of what's measurable is manageable, which is absolutely true here. I mean, how do you take what you've developed or how you've integrated that? And aside from products, what does it reveal to, you know, about risk? Maybe it's ESG risk, maybe it's climate risk. What can it tell you about sort of the mispricings in this? How can it ultimately help either a manager within your firm or an allocator to managers to, you know, again, allocate to or away from this kind of risk? So, you know, that was a long way of saying that we integrate in a number of different ways. The way I simplistically in a stylized format kind of think of responsible investment, you know, generally it's sort of exclusions or screening based, it's ESG integration and its impact in investing. There are a number of different types of those strategies within our firm. Again, when you look at ESG integration by itself, though, it's going to dramatically look different, whether it's, you know, sort of a quant strategy that has, in our case, has sort of developed a really interesting uncorrelated orthogonal factor and added it to its multi-factor mix. So I would argue it's more than a tilt, but it's sort of a real signal versus a concentrated 30 or 40 stock strategy that you know it's much more largely dependent on building out, you know, ESG data alongside an integrated free cash flow model in speaking with companies and you know having that iterative process of engagement.
Yeah, no, I think that's really helpful for managers when they're thinking about this. I guess the next question really is, obviously the Mann Group has dedicated a lot of resources to ESG considerations. And it's, you know, a global organization that's thinking about these things and has been for a long time. If there's a manager that is, you know, kind of just maybe starting out, whether they're an emerging manager or they've been in business for a few years, they're hearing all, you know, about sustainable investing, the focus on it, both from allocators like yourselves, you know, and then also from regulators, and they don't really know where to start with this. What would be kind of your advice for them as to how they could think about maybe starting, you know, thinking about ESG?
Yeah, and so this is something that we're spending a lot more time on our fund of funds business. We've got a paper that was just published, and it will come out with a case study as well. But you find just an incredibly wide spectrum of managers, as you said, that some that are very highly developed. You find those, you know, generally in the long only space, both equity and corporate fixed income, to the less well developed for a lot of different reasons. Sometimes it's lack of relevance, but you know, when you get into the alt space or quant space, I think our approach has been to try and understand integration in two dimensions, I'd say, right? I mean, you've got the firm organizational / operational level, right? So what is the firm doing to manage these kinds of risks? You know, that typically means, you know, a policy, you know, or a set of policies out there, which goes far beyond a simple statement, which is, you know, I'd say sort of a statement is a diluted, you know, kind of a soft commitment. You know, this policy is, it should point to accountability and ownership. And sometimes, you know, you find that missing or it's in development. Typically within a small manager, you'll find that born out of the compliance and legal group. And that tends to sort of develop in time into a sort of an asset management or more sort of a management sort of role. But I think it's important to sort of make sure that there's a formal organizational framework there and a policy framework there. You know, also from a reporting perspective or an analytics tools, you know, sort of a capabilities perspective, that's obviously important. We're interested in what firms are sort of onboarding and how they're implying that, you know, at the firm level to manage those kinds of risks. And then at the fund level, obviously, that's the second dimension. How are these strategies actually starting to apply that? Or, you know, and that could take two forms. One, it's about informational awareness, you know, it's sort of understanding the informational value and sort of coupling that with the actual investments, or it's dedicated products that are actually implementing that to influence, you know, sort of the nature, the nature of the investments or risk profile of the strategy.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the things that we are constantly focusing on with clients is that kind of these aspirational policies or kind of one statements about sustainability or ESG is really, you know, not where the market is currently and really definitely not where it's going to be in the future. So I know we work you know, with people thinking about that from a legal and compliance perspective and ensuring that all of their disclosures really matching what their practices are on a daily basis and not just, you know, kind of statements that their, you know, investor relations team is making to investors, you know, when they're coming in during due diligence, because that's obviously a focus both of, you know, at the SEC and obviously regulators globally. So I would just say kind of related to that, and maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, kind of this, the term that people use kind of for some of that greenwashing where people are, you know, kind of often maybe making statements in order to get a marketing effect, but not really, you know, kind of having the policies to back it up. And also what you've seen in Europe, you know, in sure. connection with some of the recent regulations that just went into effect in March there.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's one of my favorite topics. I've written an article in the Financial Times. A while ago, about a year ago, asking the question, is greenwashing a necessary evil? And the point of that is that, you know, greenwashing has sort of transfixed the industry. I mean, we are sort of at super high paranoia and suspicion around it. And that's a good thing. But we have to sort of step back and ask, I mean, first, how are we defining greenwashing? You know, even the EU, which has taken tremendous steps, I mean, more so than any other sort of jurisdiction that I've seen, you know, in terms of providing through the Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation protections against greenwashing. I mean, you will still find a very wide spectrum in Article 8 in particular, in terms of what's allowed. Away from To put SFDR, because that's a whole big issue to decide for one second. What I've argued, and I do actually think this is true, is that I think we should recognize that integration, everything that we're talking about, doesn't happen overnight, you know, and that particularly in terms of some markets, in terms of sort of developing them, I think we want to be cautious about being or applying too orthodox a definition around what's greenwashed and what isn't. The point being that if we apply such an orthodox definition, then it will allow or it will prevent markets from growing fast enough. And I mean, growing in terms of financing the low carbon economy, the just transition. Mm-hmm. You know, one great example of the podcast that I host, A Sustainable Future, is when I had a conversation with the Bank of England, Michael Shirin, who's the special advisor there. And we talked about, you know, sort of the development of the green securitization market, which is incredibly nascent, although obviously green bonds and some other green areas within fixed income have developed. But his point was, there isn't a real strong definition about what green securitization represents, but it is incredibly vital to get green assets off bank books, free up that lending just in terms of economic growth, particularly, you know, post-pandemic, and also sort of, you know, kind of develop this market. And so the question I always ask is, you know, should we allow, and I think this will be true for the SFDR as well, should we tell ourselves that we need to be comfortable over a year or 2 years with a high degree of disagreement around what greenwashing is, and let these develop a bit more. And over time, we want to see them obviously be made more rigorous. So, you know, to be clear, I'm not saying, you know, or allowing for bad behavior. We don't want to see that, but I think we do need, you know, more convergence. I mean, to turn it to SFDR, and for those who don't know it, I mean, SFDR, you know, in my mind, it's doing a couple things, but the two specific ones, it's, you know, it's attempting to provide greenwashing or protections against greenwashing to investors. And then secondly, to steer in the most explicit way, investment towards sustainable investments and away from unsustainable investments. And, you know, sort of to look at those two objectives in this light, you would think that they are aligned. I mean, they would seem to be, and they are, but there is some inherent tension between them. From a EU policymaker's perspective, what they're thinking about is, look, as a continent, Europe is trying to get to, you know, net zero by 2050. They're trying to do as much as possible to sort of incentivize this transition to a low carbon economy. And part of that means using exclusions. Which, you know, I would, you know, certainly aren't ESG integration, but you know, I know that much of the early thinking from a policymaker's perspective was, if we can incentivize, you know, the marginal unit of capital towards sustainable investments and away from unsustainable investments, that's a win, right? That's just one more unit that goes towards funding, you know, sort of a net zero economy. I think what's interesting though is the industry itself has sort of backed off that and said, well, wait a minute, but what does that marginal unit of capital actually look like? Is it something that just, you know, is dressed up with a few sectoral exclusions, you know, and calling itself an ESG product? Because that's not enough. And so I think, you know, going through March 10, when SFDR went live, you know, the first wave of funds from many managers. We're doing a lot of work right now in terms of building a matrix and understanding what the profile of many of our competitors are sort of producing. I think by and large, you know, there's a lot of good product that seems credible. What I would say though is that there is a worry, and I definitely hear this from other allocators as well, is that what does the second wave of funds following this first wave look like? Are they of lower quality? And where are the sacrifices made? Do they just come with exclusions, you know, and a lower degree of ESG? Are there, you know, do we see more untraditional products, ETFs, for instance, which obviously have inherent limitations around this? But there are a lot of questions about what happens going forward in terms of the integrity of Article 8 products, not so much on Article 9 impact products.
I mean, I think we're all kind of at the beginning of all of these stages. So it'll be very interesting to see where things develop in the next few years. We can definitely have you on again and see kind of where things are in the next 6 months or a year. I think, you know, one of the things that you,
I was going to say, yeah, if you don't mind me sort of just saying, I mean, one thing to look out for, and I think many people have sort of overlooked the MiFID II implications, you know, a year from now. But the big question is Article 8 simply too unwieldy, you know, as sort of one big category for a lot of stuff? And to what degree does that stratify or bifurcate, you know, into an 8 plus, you know, an Article 8 plus, i.e. a higher quality matching sustainable preferences versus a lower quality that does have some ESG sort of, you know, kind of exclusion criteria, but it certainly doesn't, you know, look like some of that higher quality fund. So, I mean, that's what we're kind of focused on right now. It'll be interesting to see how that develops.
It will. And it'll be interesting to see also here, you know, in the U.S., I know the SEC has made, a lot of different pronouncements more recently, under the new administration. And so it'll be interesting to see where the SEC ends up on those issues, if they, you know, kind of do follow suit, with Europe, both kind of in the issuer space and then also in the investment management space. So I think that's something we'll be, you know, obviously following closely as well here. So I know you've obviously mentioned climate in some of the discussions that we've had. And I know that the Mann Group recently just did submit a shareholder proposal to HSBC regarding climate. Maybe you can describe a little bit, you know, about kind of why you decided to take this action and just give a little bit of context for people that might not be familiar with the proposal.
Sure. For those unfamiliar, so HSBC, that shareholder resolution, it's a climate shareholder resolution. And effectively, we as a group led by ShareAction, the NGO based in the UK, and more than a dozen different asset managers and asset owners representing, I think, about 2.4, 2.5 trillion of assets under management, are effectively going to them to the board of HSBC and asking, look, let's build on your climate commitment. And I think we wanted to see a couple of things. First, their initial form of their climate commitment, they called it a climate ambition to hit net zero by 2050. And I think semantics matter in this space. There is a difference between an ambition and a commitment. And companies, particularly, you know, comms and investor relations, choose words very, very wisely. You know, I would say that an ambition isn't a commitment. I mean, you can have an ambitious commitment, you can have an unambitious commitment. And so the idea was, look, let's go to them and let's harden that into a commitment. And let's also say, you know, let's try and ask for more details to understand the shape of the curve over the next 30 years. How do you get there? Given the fact that you're one of the largest banks in terms of fossil fuel financing, particularly around coal, how are you managing that from an OECD and a non-OECD basis? And can you start thinking about replicating best practices in terms of phasing that out over decades? We went with them with a number of asks. And I'll be honest, I was sort of blown away. I think most of the co-filers were in that the management and board were incredibly receptive and constructively worked with us. And ultimately, to such a degree, embedded our asks and a number of others, including a say on climate vote to shareholders, which would reflect a very strong climate transition plan. We ultimately withdrew our shareholder proposal and HSBC tabled their own. So I actually think it is an incredible win-win for both sides. And frankly, just a fantastic opportunity for HSBC to demonstrate its leadership in the banking sector. And I actually think that this represents a seminal precedent and case study that will reverberate across other banks. Now, from a Mann perspective, it's fascinating. We, you know, if I look historically, stewardship has not been a strength of ours, you know, over the last 20 years. Why, you know, historically we've had exposure to quant and the alternative space where you have much more expression through synthetics, so you don't have a lot of which means forfeiting your voting rights. But all this is to say that a number of years ago, around 5 years ago, we started capacity building from a stewardship perspective. And that has meant a number of step functions, you know, over the last number of years, particularly manifesting through our support through shareholder resolutions like this, and then ultimately looking for opportunities. So HSBC was a fantastic opportunity to be part of it. But this certainly won't be our last. It was our first. I think it's important to note that in Man's 238-year history, this is our first shareholder proposal that we've co-filed. And again, we plan to be much more active in this area. So I don't think that we are an anomaly. I think to the credit, there are a number of other managers as well that are really sort of taking on much more seriously sort of the fiduciary obligations and, you know, sort of efforts around stewardship. So kudos to everyone.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I mean, I think that's a really powerful example for everyone of how with those types of proposals, you really can change the course of how the company is going to think about these types of issues. And obviously climate is one that's crucially important to everyone really globally. And I think it's also very powerful just to talk about the fact that this is the first one that you've, you know, done as an organization, and obviously really shows your commitment as a firm to these types of issues. For some managers that maybe not be at the stage of, you know, kind of devoting maybe the time and resources to joining, you know, other shareholders or proposing their own, you know, proposals to different issuers, what do you think are some other types of corporate engagement that they could, you know, use through their firm, whether that's, you know, kind of on the proxy voting side or, you know, kind of meetings with management, just maybe some tips for them?
Sure. So I would say two angles. I mean, first there's the engagement angle, but let me come back to that. I would say sort of mechanically, go to proxy voting. Obviously there's some regulatory obligations, you know, in certain jurisdictions and others not, but I would say examine how you're treating the recommendations from your proxy voting provider. I think what we had historically done was basically onboard them and sort of reflect that. I think what we changed dramatically over the last 5 years is basically taking back on board a lot of some of the value or the information around what's going on, and working with our proxy voting provider to effectively identify across the biggest economic positions for the firm, you know, because you can't do everything. And within that, looking for high value votes, you know, or sort of ballots, you know, where you can add your own value add. And within that, what I've found is sort of building out kind of a useful formula of, you know, what are you weighing over this process? One, you've got, you know, in terms of your inputs, you know, the first input is obviously the recommendation from your proxy voting provider. You know, it's worth scrutinizing that rather than taking it at face value. Secondly, I'd say, and this might or might not align with that first factor, but, you know, what are the priors? What's your precedence in terms of how you voted? Have you tended to vote for climate shareholder resolutions in the past within certain industries? Because that will be helpful in sort of steering you going forward, and particularly in terms of making the case for why you want to get more active going forward, right? Third, I think it's really important, and this is what has helped us, is to kind of build a feedback loop. So whereas before, I think most managers express, I'd say not most, but many managers express voting intentions either through proxy, but more actively from the firm level up. I think what we've tended to do, particularly because we have such a large quant business, is try and build a very strong stewardship team at the firm level and then create this feedback loop. So they're constantly driving information around, you know, positions or opportunities down to the investment teams and receiving information from investment teams. Not all teams. I mean, it's constantly, you know, it's a process, but that's creating a really powerful feedback loop about where we want to spend our obviously finite resources, you know, in terms of time and research, and where we want to get involved. So that's been helpful. And through that process, I think, you know, it sort of produced probably the fourth factor, which is sort of a resolution factor. You know, within a firm as large as ourselves, you want to manage conflict of interest, right? I mean, you might have a number of different strategies invested in the same company. And they might actually have different views, some more strong than others. Again, that's a good thing. But what we want to do is sort of bring that together and sort of understand where, you know, that sort of the integrity and sort of merits of the view, because ultimately what we want to do is sort of put the best view forward as long as everyone agrees. And so what that does is sort of enables, particularly, you know, a manager who runs a smaller fund, let's say, but is very engagement stewardship focused, you know, that sort of empowers that fund to vote not just the strategy's holdings, but particularly sort of a larger part of the firm's holdings. So in fact, what I'm saying is we're much better at sort of coordinating the preferences and interests around stewardship across the firm.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely, you know, something important that managers can think about, you know, kind of going forward as part of their, you know, ESG process. And obviously, you know, we very much appreciated your time today. So I'll just ask kind of one, you know, final question. We've obviously seen dramatic increases in the amount of sustainable investing, whether that's new products or assets going into, you know, different funds that are focusing on that. And it looks to only be continuing going forward. You know, what do you think are some of the kind of main risks to, you know, both for the issuers and then also for investment firms if they're not really focused on these ESG issues?
Yeah, I'd say access to markets, I mean, higher cost of capital. And particularly, I think what's starting to emerge is sort of a disparity or kind of a structural, I'd say there are some discrete areas where you can argue that a structural derating relative to the market is emerging in lower quality companies, you know, in the way that you have, you know, high yield companies tend to trade, you know, sort of more cheaply relative to investment grade. I think where, you know, what's an example? If you were to look at tobacco, tobacco is sort of interesting, right? It's sort of not on the UN Global Compact list of companies. It is increasingly being excluded from many portfolios in Canada, in Australia, all across Europe. And I think when you look at the effects of that, since these exclusions have been put in place, and I would say that's typically happened over the last 5 to 7 years, what you find is a spread emerging. So these, you know, so tobacco companies are effectively trading, you know, at cheaper multiples relative to the markets. And so I think, you know, and you might argue that short-term flows might change that, and certainly they might in a risk-off period. But I think structurally over the long term, it just means fewer investors are going to own names, and that, you know, that might be for exclusion-related reasons. It might be you know, an ESG profile-related reasons. But I think we're starting to finally see the effects of capital flows, you know, show up as a big risk for many of these companies.
Great. Well, Jason, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. You know, Jason's contact information as well as my contact information is available if you have any questions. And then also I would, you know, highly suggest that you also listen to his podcast, The Sustainable Future, you know, which you can find on any of kind of the major podcast platforms. He always has a great, you know, interviews with a lot of people that are really thoughtful on this topic. So.
Great. Thanks. Again, the wonderful time, and thank you so much for the invitation.
Yeah, no, thank you.